and that what we call the spinal chakras are the reflexes of the brain chakras in the mirror of mind. That the neural system carries the reflexes into various parts of the body, but that the chakras themselves are in the seven primary caves of the brain. Why do the tantras say this? Why? For a very simple reason. Namely, that the entire chakra concept is mental. The entire procedure is mind influencing mind. The entire engendering of the theory and the working out of the theory is a phenomenon within the field of mental energy. In order, therefore, we will say, to meditate upon the chakra, it must be conceived of mentally. It cannot be regarded as an organ which can be examined by persons of all beliefs. While it's a little inconvenient, perhaps, to examine your liver just as a casual procedure, still, it is perfectly possible for us to know the approximate shape and size of livers by autopsy and dissection, or by the very excellent models now made in Germany and, I believe, soon to be released from Japan, bearing upon this phase of the subject. In other words, any physical structure can be explored, can be examined, its size, shape, substance, and materials estimated with reasonable accuracy. Such is not true of the chakras. The chakras can be explored only by mind, can be visualized only by mental concentration, can be known and experienced only by mental reflex. Therefore, in the chakras, you have a very rarefied group of mental organs arising within the substance of man's mental existence. And as a result of that, being subject to all conditioning that is possible to a mental structure or form in nature. Now, here is one of the problems that immediately presents itself on this basis. The mind being used for the visualization of these spinal mandala, which is what they actually are, engenders in consciousness the symbolic shape. This shape is fixed by tradition. The shape of this chakra and its content, the numerous tantric symbols included in it, symbols which are derived from the various levels of the Hindu religion and have been specialized in the yoga tantric system. These symbols are internally visualized as existing. Perhaps the beginner, the novice, works from a physical chart which shows these forms, with which he becomes mentally and psychologically familiar. The purpose that he is attempting to achieve is, therefore, to release the energy symbolically represented by this form. By releasing the energy, what he is actually trying to do, whether he realizes or not, is to reverse the process of mental control and restore what might be termed the pure energy, which has been blocked by mental phenomena. Therefore, these seven seals represent the symbols of seven blockages, seven transitory conditions set up by the sensory reflexes of man, resulting in seven basic mistakes. These seven basic mistakes stand between the individual and the, we will say, the intimate, immediate realization of the life power of the heart. To overcome these, therefore, he must overcome the instruments of phenomena which he has set up. He is therefore actually attempting to lead the life energy out of the subterranean region in which it has become involved, carry it back again to its own true and proper nature by dissolving one by one the fixations of mind by which this energy is held imprisoned or is held in a highly specialized process. To do this, of course, the Tantra process must achieve the victory of right use over wrong use. That is its primary function. Therefore, the processes of the seven so-called steps must be redeemed from false use. True use must be established. True use must come through realization. And here, within the structure of mind, we find a contrary system established by means of which mind gradually overcomes itself. It is all part of the same process, inasmuch as your yogic system must end in samadhi. It must end in the Buddhist nirvana. It must end in the total release of true consciousness from the ego fixation. This is represented in the Eastern system by the final victory of Atman, the universal, the one which alone is real, and man's ability to achieve union, which is the true meaning of the word yoga, union with the infinite, union with that which is unconditioned. Therefore, it is not right to assume that the chakras can be anything more nor less than the seven steps for attaining victory over illusion. Now, as seven steps for attaining victory, man attains the victory by attaining victory over the symbolism of the chakra itself. He gains his victory by mastering these wheels. Now, the word chakra actually means a whirling wheel. Now, the whirling wheel, which is sometimes shown balanced or poised upon the finger point of the god Vishnu, this wheel is a reminder of the Tantra that these centers are in constant motion. All of these chakras should be represented as spinning violently. And the direction in which they spin is of the greatest importance, because in each case, victory consists in the reversal of the direction. This is very significant as we proceed. But why do these chakras always appear or seem to be spinning? The answer is that in the condition of man, all of the so-called aspects of mental energy are in constant motion. There is no stability in the mental energy. It is continually in movement. It is continually in conflict. It is continually contradicting itself. And these chakras represent conditions which are constantly in alternation within their own structure, like the wheel of fortune that goes round and round, and where it stops, nobody knows. It is the same as the ancient wheel of fortune represented in Egypt and in Greece and in medieval mythology, which later appeared also upon the Taroki cards or the tarot deck, the wheel in which four figures are fastened to the rim, and as one figure falls, another rises. And when that figure in turn falls, the one that was low rises again. It is this endless turning of the wheel, the turning of the Buddhist prayer wheel, the turning constantly of the alternation of the nidanas, or the conditions of existence, constantly spinning. All conditions, therefore, spin upon the axis of illusion, and there can be no permanence, reality, or fixedness in them. The purpose of the concept seems to lie in the fact that in the seven states of mental existence represented by the chakras, there can be no fixedness. There can be nothing that is truly so, nothing that is inevitably not so, nothing that is finally good, nothing that is ultimately bad. These are only sequences of conditions. And conditions themselves are what are called dependencies. Each condition is dependent upon the previous for its own existence, and that which is subsequent is dependent upon that which precedes it. Thus, the wheel goes continuously. And in all of the chakra areas, the motion of the wheel was the ancient symbol of instability. That everything is movable in the universe except the axis, the mysterious, invisible center upon which the wheel turns, alone is immovable. And in the Kala Chakra system, the axis of the wheel is actually the heart. The heart, therefore, becomes the axis of a wheel, and around it move the six conditions represented by the six other heavenly bodies, the three inferior and the superior conditions. The three superior conditions are the three states of the elevation of mental phenomena. The three inferior conditions are the three unfortunate or misery-causing states of mental phenomena. And the wheel continues to turn. For a little success, a little sorrow. For a little of gain, a little of loss. For greatness of hope, a moderation of despair. All things moving continuously upon instability. And in the midst of this, the lord of instability, the mind itself. Yet man has nothing else with which to conquer mind but mind. He has no way of achieving mastery. The heart cannot give him particulars. The heart cannot instruct him in this or in that. The heart, therefore, cannot wage war with mind, because it has none of the objective instruments by means of which mind has created not only its wonderful neural structure, but the ancient symbol of this, the spider in its web. For the nervous system is the great web with which the spider has spun its existence. In this system or symbolism, therefore, we have these chakra points, which represent, therefore, the central patterns, the archetypes of seven conditions by means of which the unconditioned, or that which is true, is obscured. The mind has seven patterns upon which it operates. These, we might say, are like the notes of a musical scale. The mind ascends through seven steps or stages, moving from the infinitely personal to the infinitely impersonal. And the victory of mind over mind is in a mysterious way the only victory which man can achieve, inasmuch as the mind is his militant instrument. The mind is the mysterious power by means of which the error of the mind itself can be discovered. Thus, as the mind has been shown to produce logic, to destroy that which is illogical, mind has produced reason to overcome that which is unreasonable, always remembering that the mind also generated the illogical, which it later had to correct, and also was the source of the unreasonable over which it ultimately had to gain a victory. And always remembering that the reasonable of today will probably be the unreasonable of tomorrow, and that no degree of mental attainment which man can achieve can be other than the victory of a new mind over an old one, or the victory of today's thinking over yesterday's thinking. The mind can therefore battle only itself. It can have a victory only over itself. It can make a fool of nothing but itself. And actually, it is the only power that we have by means of which man can lead himself out of the maze of mind. And the old mystics, being well aware of this fact, then created a rather stable pattern to lure the mind away from its own negations, to conquer step by step the primary fallacies of the mind, to achieve ultimately the overcoming of the ultimate fallacy of the mind, which is the fallacy of selfness. This in itself must lead then to that which is beyond self, and that is the Atman, or the reconstruction of man's relationship to the concept of self, so that self is no longer the personal being, but the universal being, and that allegiance is transferred from the will of the individual to the silent will of space itself. As we know that the end of yoga is union through liberation, we can only safely assume that the steps of yoga are steps toward liberation by the mind overcoming its own previous fixations, these fixations being due largely to the symbolic testimony of the senses. Therefore, one of the sensory perceptions is associated with each of the chakras, and the victory over that testimony of the senses achieves ultimately the victory over the error or the false premise which this has set up in the mental equipment of the individual. On this basis, therefore, it can be quite definitely pointed out that the true chakras are in the mind. And the mind, because it occupies an area in juxtaposition with the brain, we may say, for general purposes, that the true chakras are in the seven important nerve centers of the brain. That the brain, therefore, extends these down through the bodily system itself. Now, one of the points that is very interesting about mental phenomena, which I think we all have begun to realize, is that this phenomena is substantial in its own realm of energy. We can see this mysterious fur-like nervous emanation which comes around the body of man, so that also inwardly, when seen from the level of neural vitality, the whole body is a glowing network of nerves. These nerves have their own light and light color in themselves. And they have very much the color which we most commonly associate with nervous energy, and that is a yellow or luminous golden color. Seen, therefore, from the level of nervous energy itself, by extrasensory perception, the entire body is a glowing mass of this yellow light. Now, the sensory perceptions arose from the structure of organs. The arterial structure of organs became in turn the archetype for the neural structure of sensory perceptions. Therefore, the vital organs of the body are also associated with our nervous organs, which are the chakra centers, which correspond to the physical organs of the body. Thus, as the nervous complex develops, as the individual becomes more and more involved in the development of this, of his highly structured nervous system, we perceive a structural development within the nervous nature itself. And we find emerging in the nerve field of the human body when seen as luminosity that there are these so-called seven fountains of constantly pulsing nerve energy. And that these seven fountains represent the principal divisions into which nerve energy can be divided. These again result in a psychological situation, because the nerve energy being septenary, the upper three parts of the septenary constituting the higher nerve energy, we generally term today as mental energy. The lower three parts we then also consider to be nervous emotional energy. And the middle point corresponding to the sun, the fourth from each end in this septenary, the sun itself represents the pure energy of the nervous system. Thus, the nervous system is polarized. And the problem that psychology works with in its effort to understand the situation is that there is a mental nervous energy and an emotional nervous energy. These are both out of equilibrium. And the only thing that is in true equilibrium is pure nervous energy itself, which corresponds to the heart as being the center or balance of the neural field. Nervous energy, as we function with it in the body, has to have a kind of link with matter, a link which corresponds very closely in relation to the arterial venous system with the lymphatic system. And we have to have the equivalent of the nerve lymphatic. This nerve lymphatic has to function in two ways. One, it has to unite the two principal nervous systems, which correspond to the two principal systems of blood. It has to link the cerebrospinal and the autonomic processes, which are merely two directions of nerve energy. Also, both parts of the nervous field, the total nervous field, must be linked with the physical body by a series of binders. For the nerve energy cannot affect matter or a material physical structure unless there is a link by means of which these two are related together. Now, the link that is known to antiquity, the classical link between these two, is a kind of magnetic field, which partakes somewhat of the nature of nerve energy and somewhat of the nature of matter. We have to have a structure which corresponds with the mysterious aether or akasha of the ancients. This is the fluid mist, the airy water, the subtle matter, the agent which carries within itself the power to link the two opposites. It must therefore lie between them. And in this we have what the old alchemists and the medieval Rosicrucians referred to as the etheric binder. This etheric binder was sufficiently subtle to take into itself nerve energy, and sufficiently gross to be able to communicate this nerve energy to matter. It formed the bridge, a kind of antis carana between these two fields of existence. So wherever nerve functions in body, nerve force moving through nerve structure into body, there has to be these links. The nerve energy itself is one thing. The nerve tube through which it passes is another. The nervous energy is one substance, the tube is another. Thus, the channel belongs to the body and the energy does not. And the energy must be channeled in this tube by means of the so-called etheric binder. The interesting thing that we now come to in connection with this situation is that the so-called etheric binder was one of the agents which a long time ago came very closely and completely under the control of the mind. Thus, the etheric binder, or this mysterious magnetic field, comes under the dominion of thought. And it is because of this that by means of the mind, a series of physical phenomena can be produced. As, for example, if you have the skill and the understanding, you can cause patches of color to appear on any part of the body by sending mental energy there by direct effort. You can also stop circulation in various parts of the body or stimulate it in the same way. And if you are gifted as a magnetic healer, you may be able to send sufficient of your own magnetic energy into another body to break up congestion or to stimulate function. These processes are carried by mental intensity. And always this energy moves according to volition, according to the activating, guiding power of the agent, which in this case is man. In this same field also, we find the area of imagination. For we know that anything which the mind conjures up, nervous etheric energy can formulate into patterns or designs, so that we may create visual images. We may create symbols within our own psychic neural structure. We may also, therefore, develop the power to create various forms and later develop the faculties to see what we have created. Every intensity of human emotion creates mathematical, geometrical, vibratory forms. Some have called these thought forms. But whatever we may want to say, every emotion and every thought has a number, a color, a form, and a sound. And we cannot escape this, no matter how hard we try. So that our thoughts become mental things. And if the mental things with which our thoughts become involved, there are perhaps none more difficult for us to live with than the products of our own negative thinking. Because in this process of negative thinking, we are working in a wonder world of mental energy. These emotion thought forms which we generate, we obviously generate within the mental nature. Therefore, these forms, whether they be mental or emotional thought forms, actually are generated within the mind itself. But because of our very natural processes of mind, we project them, just as the mind projects the chakras. And as a result of that, these forms, these thought entities, can be seen as something separate from ourselves, although they have no substance except in ourselves. We can project them. Just as, for example, if there is a phase of psychology in which we can project an image from within the subconscious and project it objectively as a visual form and see this image as distinct and apart from ourselves. This is one type of ghost, the ghost being a reverse perception from within ourselves, projecting itself in such a way that its image is recorded in the brain at the same time that visual image of places or a place is recorded, so that we may be standing in a room which is properly recorded and sees also standing in that room a person who is not there, because the person has been imposed within the mind upon the thing actually seen by the sensory perception. Now, this further to our purpose at the moment simply means that if any person deeply concerned with problems such as yoga and tantra develops a certain type of mental intensification, they can cause the symbolic, diagrammatic forms of these chakras to be created in the mind. These forms can then be visualized in relationship to the body. And it is perfectly conceivable that the individual could see, as a result of the imagination moving ether, which is a reflecting medium, can actually see in the body any of the processes which are described in yoga. The thing he must realize, however, is that he has created them out of his own thinking. This does not mean that the yoga processes are not true, but it does mean that these processes are not necessarily identical with our expectancy about them. And the thing we see is in terms of our expectancy, because it is created by ourselves. Now, the practical side of this, and there is always a practical side to these problems, is that an individual can come, and many have come to me, who were in a rather terrible state of mind. They had taken a half a dozen lessons in yoga from an outstanding exponent who disappeared soon after and was not seen again. And as a result of this procedure, these individuals were beginning to have strange symptoms. And the only thing that they could finally decide was that their interior yogic chakric system had been badly mistreated by one cause or another, and that therefore they were in a horrible state, and about the only thing they could hope for was better luck in the next incarnation. These people described all of the unhappy symptoms which they theoretically assumed would accompany yoga. They insisted that at some time when they were least expecting it and really weren't even looking at that moment, this tremendous power of the Kundalini surged upward like a geysering oil well, burst into their brain, went out of the top of their head, and took their common sense with it. Now, this situation actually happens. People under such conditions are quite naturally frightened to death. And from this situation has arisen the belief that by wrong practices or by incorrect guidance, a great spiritual injury has been performed. Under this kind of terror and under the prevailing mental tyranny which would associate with it, lives have been completely wrecked and individuals have finally landed in hopeless mental breakdown and been confined in institutions. Actually, the chakras were not touched, moved, or involved, because nobody could actually create the condition which was described as a result of 6 lessons or 66 lessons. The actual moving of this peculiar psychic agent is so profound and involved a problem that the individual who was in trouble could not even have approached the beginning of it. What they had actually done was create a complete mental chain of chakras and blown this apart with their own fear. Now, this type of thing can happen, does happen, and another individual, incidentally, with a little psychic vision, might appear to see what they have seen, and they can get confirmation, because their own thought form has set up these etheric thought patterns which can be seen by another person. But the fact they can be seen still does not make them so. For in this entire phenomenon of mind, there is nothing that the mind testifies to that is finally true. This is an amazing but important fragment of philosophy. The fact that the mind has decided it is in itself prima facie evidence that there's something wrong with it. For the only truth is that which the mind cannot conceive. So the mind is, at best, an organ of diminishing error, in which by degrees we can overcome its most flagrant mistakes, but we cannot overcome its final mistake, which is self-existence, until, as the ancients believed, we had achieved the samadhi, or the final union with absolute being. So in the chakra problem, we are dealing with a series of symbols. The actual process in Tantra, in the higher schools of Tantra, was not the idea that by means of will and mind, the individual was to change the structure of the chakra. The chakra is a condition. Conditions are not changed by will and yoga. Conditions are changed essentially by a kind of gradual transformation of value. Thus, the meditation significance of the chakra is very simple. The purpose of it is that man shall gradually experience the mystery of the error, by means of which the energy associated with the chakra is locked to a false usage. The purpose, therefore, is not to influence the chakra, not to force it, not to gain a valiant victory over it. The purpose of the meditation is to remove the error related to it. Now, the error related to the chakra is always the error of the use of energy. The chakra represents a pattern which has a true purpose and a false purpose. While it is negatively bound to the network of the nervous body system, the chakra is not fulfilling its essential purpose. For each of the sensory perceptions has as its final purpose the mingling of itself with all others for the attainment of the process or achievement of illumination or cosmic consciousness. This is not possible because in each chakra, the consciousness factor is locked on the side of phenomena or on the side of physical function. Thus, every energy that is falsely bound to a physical process must be liberated in order that this energy may return to its proper state. And when the energies of the seven sensory factors are all returned to their proper state, the result is illumination. It is the holding of the energy to false usage, or to inadequate usage, or the locking of the power of this energy away from those procedures which are natural to it and essential to its function. This is what the Yoga Chakra School seeks to understand and correct. So we have the releasing, or the so-called opening, of the centers. This opening is, and never can be, associated in itself with danger, because good can never be dangerous. Furthermore, by its own various procedures, these chakra energies have to be released in order, in sequence, and by degrees. And the energy of even the least of these chakras has to be released in four stages. And in some of the chakras, the energy has to be released by 16 stages. In others, by 12 stages, but none less than 2 stages. And in the body itself, the number cannot be less than 4. The only one that can be less than 4 is the Ajna chakra in the forehead. which is of two petals only and represents the one exception to this rule. But each of these is released by the meditation upon the meaning of the letter upon the petals. Now, this has to be done by knowledge, by an actual factual awareness of facts. It is no more possible to go somewhere, sit down, and close your eyes tightly and go to work on this problem than it is to fly to the moon without mechanical help. With mechanical help, we may make it. But we still will not be able to solve the mystery of the moon in the chakra. And there is one there. The answer to the situation, of course, lies in the relaxation of the uses of these energies as the individual gains equilibrium, freedom from excess. It is said that the petals open. In other words, the petals relax. Opening is relaxation. It is the assertion of the normal over the subnormal or the abnormal. In the case of man, these centers are originally represented as buds because they represent potentials of consciousness with the consciousness locked in them. By the quietude of consciousness, the kundali, which is the symbol in man of the ascending power of the pure volition of Atman, the kundali or kundalini is therefore the tracing of the path of true growth as opposed to all apparent or seeming growth. It is the gradual rising of the pure essence of consciousness through conditions to its final unconditioned release. It is the gradual unfolding of those creative powers in man which must finally have their final victory over the mental complex of idea sensation. So the achievement consists in the same way as the various steps in all the disciplines of religion. There is almost certainly an analogy also between the idea that man had that there were originally seven important religions, and that these religions are in turn associated with the chakras. These religions probably stem from or are responsible for the concept of the seven churches. There is no question that each of these religious systems is keyed primarily to a different key note, although the object is always identical. The purpose of the religion is always a state of holiness. But each in its own way has a basic psychological concept as to how this is to be attained. There are religions of love, religions of service, religions of wisdom, religions of courage. There are religions which teach positive doctrine, and others which seem to teach negative doctrines. And the ancients simply held that the great religions of the world were themselves, more or less, this symbol of the chakra chain, or as it's referred to by Sri Krishna in, I believe, the Uttara Gita, there is this idea of the one thread passing through the seven beads. Now, the seven beads can be the seven chakras. The seven beads can be the seven religions. They can be the seven races. They can be the seven continents, the seven forms of life, the species, the genera of all things. But wherever this septenary occurs, it finally tells us that the creative power itself, represented in Tantra by Shiva, that the creative power itself in meditation creates the seven worlds from its own mental chakra centers, and that the creation is the setting in motion of the seven wheels or chakras within the structure of universal mind. In this, the atmosphere gets rather thin, but at the same time, the symbolism is meaningful and I think has basic significance for us. That this septenary, which we find in nature, therefore always flows back into the sign and symbol of the great mendicant. And that is Shiva, seated on the top of the mountains of Himavat, wearing the garment of ashes as the symbol of mendicancy, holding the tridenta, and with the river Ganga or Ganges pouring out of his head. But in this meditation symbol, the deity enters into, in descending order, the consciousness of the seven ganglia of the nervous mental consciousness, and from each of these levels causes a creation to flow out. Man is one of these creations. Each form of nature repeats, therefore, in miniature, the procedures of the great mendicant. The same mendicant draws the universe back into itself again in the end of the great period of manifestation by reversing the visualizing process and causing the consciousness to ascend again through the seven conditions to the unconditioned. Thus, involution is the emergence of all these worlds coming forth out of the great chakra wheels of universal mind energy. Evolution is the reversal of the motion of the wheel and the gradual reabsorption of condition into the unconditioned on each level. Therefore, if we wish to take one of the chakras, let us, for instance, take the heart chakra, for example, which apparently is the chakra that was of the greatest significance in the Pure Land Gospel of Buddha. In this chakra, we have the concept, therefore, of the radiant power represented by the Buddha Amitabha, seated in the midst of this great lotus. And these deities are always lotus thrones. And these lotus thrones are the chakra in each case. But it's seated in the midst of this lotus throne and the victory of the heart as a victorious fact over the illusion of desire, which is its negative fact. The victory of compassion over passion. The victory of love over desire. The victory of release over possessiveness. The victory of love over hate. The victory of all things in their own nature, right, true, or good, over their extensions, or their misinterpretations, or their confusions as a result of the impact of external phenomena. The victory in each case is the restoration of the simple fact of the thing. Therefore, when from the heart chakra, which we have variously used in our functions, someone says, have a heart. Someone else says, he's kind-hearted. Another individual says, his heart is in the right place. These are tremendously dynamic statements. We never could imagine a heart being anywhere else. But anyway, it sounds good. Psychologically, we are now referring to the goodness of the heart. When the simple fact of the goodness of the heart achieves victory over the compromises which we make of affection, regard, friendship, in the concourse of daily life, when the heart becomes the seat of goodness, and this goodness gains victory over the illusion of compromise, we may then say that the heart chakra opens. The discipline by which it is achieved may involve the recognition of the chakra, the recognition of the unfolding of it. But the discipline is meaningless unless it is accompanied by a series of transformations of conduct, by which in fact and in action,
man's understanding is transformed from selfishness to selflessness, from egoism to non-egoism, from personal to universal. And when the transformations have occurred in the conduct of and character of the individual, the ancients decided or revealed that this energy, which has been locked in misuse, now begins to flow out in its natural purpose. And the nature of this energy is therefore represented by the 12 petals of this flower. And with these petals opening, the victory of this consciousness over the 12 nidanas, which are the conditions of existence, which can all be solved by true love. The victory, therefore, of the chakra simply means that its energy is now devoted to solution rather than to confusion, and that by an experience of consciousness, we have achieved the opening of this flower upon the mysterious rod, which is we call the spine. This is the symbol of the blossoming of the rod of Joseph, and in the Tannhäuser legend, the blossoming of the staff of the penitent who is forgiven because his rod blossoms. And the blossoming upon the staff is, of course, the symbol of repentance, but most of all, it is the symbol of God's witness that this repentance is accepted, which simply means that the divine power is then moving through these blossoms in its own appointed way, and that pure consciousness is beginning to move out through the neural system. And that as a result of that, the nervous energy thus becomes a redeemed energy. And that which was the betrayer becomes the redeemer. And in the end, as the Persians say, Ormuzd, the spirit of light, and Ahriman, the principle of darkness, are reconciled. And it is in the nervous field that good and evil, right and wrong, truth and error, must make their great struggle and finally be reconciled, because good and evil are brothers. They are both derived from the same energy. They are both supported by the same energy. But enlightenment releases this energy from evil and dedicates it to good. The wheels reverse their motion, and the Dharma chakra, or the wheel of the law that is forever turning, turns towards redemption rather than toward embodiment and toward the Dharma of unfulfilled personal desire. This, I think, perhaps will give us a little different concept of this, perhaps a little nearer to the teachings of the great essential Tantra before it was disfigured by various adulterations of belief, in other words, before the mind took it over and ruined it. But to redeem it again, it is once more the victory of true consciousness over mental consciousness. And from this, the ultimate victory of silence over all sound. Because it is in the great heart chakra, I think, that Dr. Suzuki got consolation for his idea of a man or the Zen monk slapping his hands together and saying, "You hear the sound?" And then the disciple says, "Yes." Now the master said, "Make a sound by slapping one hand together." And the disciple had a little trouble with that. But in the 12 petal chakra, according to the tantric scripture, comes from this chakra, the heart chakra, the sound that is not caused by any two objects striking. This is one of the keys of the chakra. So in this, we have this concept of pilgrimage, of shrines, of the pilgrim going along the path and stopping to pay tribute at the various shrines of his faith. And in each of these shrines, making the offering of his life afresh to the principle represented by the enshrined power or the enshrined deity. And by this mysterious journey, the individual, therefore, releases the true energy which he has from bondage to the mind and restores it again to the service of pure consciousness itself. Well, that's quite a little to think about. Maybe that'll do for tonight.